Welcome to The Craft of Preaching, an online conference hosted by Luther Seminary, October 5th through 7th, 2020. This workshop by Michael Chan is entitled The Hard Texts, Spiritual Practices and Hermeneutical Approaches for Preaching the Bible's Most Challenging Passages.
Good to see everybody. Katie's right that you must be the brave ones in this this batch of folks that are here for Craft of Preaching, because this is, of course, on the hard text, and I absolutely love this topic. We had a great conversation in the last session. In fact, I made a couple of adjustments to the presentation based off of that, and so I'm really looking forward to the presentation and then also the conversation afterward. Here's how the time's going to be structured. I'll do a little bit of talking here, probably 20, 25 minutes worth, maybe 30 minutes worth. Throughout that time, you should feel free to, if you have a question that you feel like is very, very pertinent to like a particular point I'm making, just feel free to interrupt and ask. If you have a question that you think can maybe wait until the end, then you can either hold on to that, at which point we'll give you, you know, an opportunity to voice that question, or you can even put it in chat. If you want to just have a record of it there. So just, there are a couple different ways to interact. You don't need to raise your hand or anything. If you need to cut in and ask a question, just literally unmute yourself and interrupt me. I can't see everybody's face. So if you raise your hand or something, it's likely that you'll be ignored. Not because I want you to be ignored, but because I just can't see everybody. I think we have a couple pages worth of Zoom images here. So that's sort of some protocols for our time together. I'll just say a few things about what I do at Luther. I am, like Katie, I'm also on the Faith Lead team. Definitely check out that the Faith Lead website is just full of awesome resources. I also teach Old Testament at Luther. And so dealing with the hard text is sort of what I do on a daily basis, as you know, as somebody who teaches in the Old Testament, especially books like Jeremiah and Daniel and some of these more bizarre books that we have there. So thanks again for joining the session. And let me, let's see, I think my screen share is working. Is that right? Katie, do you see my screen? No? Okay, let me do the screen share. I thought it was up.
Ah, there you go.
Okay. Now, the image here on the left is kind of a modern depiction of Jacob wrestling with God in Genesis 32. It's just the stunning and dynamic image, and I love it. And in many ways, for me, that is kind of a metaphor for what we're going to talk about in the session, how we wrestle that blessing out of, right? out of these texts, because that's often, I think, how it feels when you start to engage some of these hard texts. Is it feels like you're actually, it's not just that you're pushing against the text, but the text pushes back, right? And that's what's hard about some of these texts, is that there's like a battle going on. And so I love that image. It's a metaphor that we'll return to. I would remind you that when you know, when Jacob has his encounter with this divine being, he comes away with a couple things, right? He comes away with a new name, but he also comes away with a limp, right? He's injured from the rest of his life. He's injured from this encounter, and in many ways, my prayer is that as we wrestle with these texts, not that we would be injured, but that we would leave in a way that we are marked for life. Right, that we would be able to leave the encounter in a way that we would be marked, and that it would be memorable and also ultimately useful for the congregations that we serve. So, let's do a little bit of imagination exercise here. All right, you walk through your church office doors at the beginning of the week, and I'm guessing most of your church office doors don't have the 95 theses on them like this one does in Wittenberg, but we'll pretend. You walk through the church office doors at the beginning of the week, and you sit down at your desk. Maybe we're doing all this from home now because it's COVID, but you sit down at your desk to check the lectionary. Maybe it's narrative lectionary, maybe it's RCL, maybe it's whatever. Maybe you're going through the whole Bible or something. But you check on this week's text, and it's one of those texts. Right? You look at it and you think, well, I guess I could preach from the epistle this week. Or, well, maybe I should preach from the book club book this week. Or whatever it is, it's one of those texts. And I think what's remarkable about like hard texts is that they're sometimes different for all of us. Like a hard text for you might be different might not be the same, you know, text that's hard for me. And so there's a little bit of kind of subjectivity here as well that we'll want to keep in mind. But how many of you, and we're going to do a little bit of interaction here through chat. If you have ever had this experience, I want you to put an X into the chat. And the experience is this, where you looked at the text and you chose to avoid preaching or teaching on a particular text because you just didn't want to deal with it. If you have ever had that experience, put an X into chat, okay? Right. Of course, you know, many of us have had this experience. Don't even need to sort of poll us. But for my part, I have had this experience as well. The Bible is full of these texts, is it not? Both Old Testament and New Testament. And based on the chatter that I'm seeing kind of online this month, Matthew, you know, the Matthew text that we're working through right now represents some of these difficult texts, especially as you kind of move further into Matthew, into some of the more apocalyptic type material. Some of those texts would give you a headache, just like this gentleman on the screen, you know, on my PowerPoint has. Now here's, let me say something about the tone of this presentation I'm going to make. I'm going to come at you really hard with a couple of claims, and then I'm going to soften them a little bit, okay, and nuance them a little bit. Here is, okay, we did this already. Here's ultimately my goal in doing that. My goal in leaving this course is that you will leave with additional strategies and bolstered courage to preach and teach from difficult texts. That is my only goal, is that you'll have even just a tiny bit more courage to preach from texts that maybe yesterday you would have avoided. Or maybe last week you would have avoided. Maybe you'll have just a tiny bit more fire in your belly to take on one of these texts, to take the risk to preach or teach from one of these texts. Now, let me offer a thought from my doctoral supervisor, Brent Strawn, who was at Emory at the time. He would always say to us, we have to preach from these hard texts. And he would say, don't leave these texts to lesser preachers. Don't leave these hard texts to lesser preachers. We have to preach from these texts. And why? Why do we need to preach from these texts? Just because we don't preach from them doesn't mean that folks in our congregations aren't going to hear them. People are going to encounter these difficult biblical texts, texts about the apocalypse and the end of the world, texts about judgment, texts that deal with that depict women in really in horrific ways, texts about whether women should be in ministry or not. Your people, our people, are going to encounter these texts, and maybe they'll go on to YouTube, right? And so then you have to ask yourself the question: do you really want YouTube teaching your congregation about, you know, whether women should be in the pulpit? Do you want YouTube teaching people about God's judgment? Do you really want YouTube teaching about the end of times? And I think in most cases, the answer is no. You do not want YouTube to be teaching these kinds of things. So if we avoid them, in my view, we are engaging in ministry malpractice. To be sure, it might make us feel better that we don't have to deal with these hard texts. You know, inside we might feel better, but avoiding them is not going to necessarily mean that your congregation won't encounter these texts. And so the first argument I want to make is, don't leave these texts to lesser preachers, meaning take the responsibility and we're going to deal with them ourselves. And then secondly, there are so many different ways for people to interpret some of these difficult texts, and often those interpretations are done in very damaging ways or in ways that can really harm faith. And so it's important that we kind of model how to engage some of these more difficult texts, and we're going to talk about some ways to do that shortly. By ignoring tough texts, we deprive our congregations of the opportunity to learn how to wrestle with difficult texts and ideas and topics in Scripture. I'm a parent. We have a 1-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I have recently noticed that I think our kids are, I underestimate them. I think they're often far more capable of dealing with difficult topics than I think that they are. I always have this tendency, and there's probably some good in this, to want to kind of remove the gray, right? To want to make the world appear a little bit more predictable than it actually is, to kind of simplify things. And I think there's a tendency within congregations for this to happen as well, that the pastor somehow feels like it is his or her obligation to free people from complexity, to free people from the experience of experiencing a complex Bible, a complex faith. And I think there's a deep insecurity there that often feeds that we think that somehow people are unable to deal with complicated matters. And the truth is, I think that people are often mostly capable of dealing with contradictions. We all have profound contradictions in all of our lives. None of us have kind of seamless ways of moving through the world. And the same is true of all of our congregation members. And so part of what we want to do by teaching and preaching about these difficult texts is modeling and walking together and accompanying our people through these difficult faith questions, because often difficult faith questions are often tied closely to difficult texts, right? There are some connections there. And so by breaking open and teaching and preaching on difficult texts, we're also helping our congregations to think through complex faith issues. But if we think that our only job, you know, on a Sunday is kind of for people to feel good on the way out, then we might have troubles engaging some of this material. So one more point here, and then I'm going to pause and see if there are questions. Struggling with difficult texts is part of our Reformation heritage. It's part of the Protestant heritage. So here we have, of course, a picture of Martin Luther on the right. Let me read this little quote from him, which comes from the preface to his Latin writings from 1545, so kind of later in his life. "Though I lived as a monk without reproach, I, Luther, felt that I was a sinner before God with an extremely disturbed conscience. I could not believe that he, God, was placated by my satisfaction. I did not love, yes, I hated the righteous God who punishes sinners, and secretly, if not blasphemously, certainly murmuring greatly, I was angry with God and said, as if indeed it is not enough that miserable sinners, eternally lost through original sin, are crushed by every kind of calamity, by the law of the Decalogue, without having God add pain to pain by the gospel, and also by the gospel threatening us with his righteousness and wrath. Thus I raged with a fierce and troubled conscience. Nevertheless, I beat importunately upon Paul at that place." He's talking here about his wrestling with Romans 1:17. "Most ardently desiring to know what St. Paul wanted. At last, by the mercy of God, meditating day and night, I gave heed to the context of the words, namely, in it the righteousness of God is revealed, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. There I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that by which the righteous lives by a gift of God, namely by faith. And this is the meaning. The righteousness of God is revealed by the gospel, namely the passive righteousness with which merciful God justifies us by faith, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. Here I felt that I was altogether born again and had entered paradise itself through the open gates." So the point I want to make here, though, is that at the heart of the Reformation, of Luther's key insight, is this wrestling, this lengthy wrestling match that he had with Paul, and especially with the first chapter of Romans. And so one of the... I would hope that Luther would serve as a bit of a model for us, that as we engage these texts, we will do as Luther does and beat importunately right upon Paul or Jeremiah or whoever it is we happen to be wrestling with, and that we will do so with persistence, recognizing that that we may come out at the other end as Jacob did with both a blessing and a wound, but nonetheless, we will come out with insight and we'll come out with the ability to help our congregation members wrestle through kind of these complicated texts. So I want to pause here for just a moment. I've kind of teed things up at this point and talked about why I think it's important that we deal with difficult texts, how I think it's close to very close to the heart of Protestant theology. What we're going to do in the second part of the talk is give you some really practical and specific strategies for teaching and engaging and learning from difficult, hard texts. But are there any questions up to this point? Okay, great. We will continue on. And as we continue, feel free to just take note of questions. All right, here's the first one. Dig deeper, linger longer. These texts often require us to spend a significantly more time with them than, say, you know, all of us have those texts that like sort of agree with our theology and the sermon sort of falls off the page. Like, that's not the kind of text we're talking about. We're talking about the kind of text that you would read it and say, yeah, we're not preaching on that this week. those are precisely the text that we need to preach on. But in order to do so, it is going to be more time consuming. And so think about, I'm sure that all of you have, you know, folks in your maybe a one or two people in your congregation whose personality is such that it is more difficult to kind of get to know them, that maybe it takes a little bit longer. Maybe they're a little bit rough around the edges. Maybe they're a little bit, you know, kind of push your patience in some ways. In many ways, we should think about these difficult texts in that way, right? It's going to take you longer as a pastor or a leader to build rapport and trust with the person who might have some kind of rough edges, or maybe just your personalities don't immediately jive. It's going to take time for you to develop that relationship. It's going to take time for them to trust you and for you to be able to open up with them. Similarly, with these texts, it's going to take more time to get to know them. And so you need to be patient with yourself. I often, when I have a text that is really giving me problems, I try to study that text in as many places as possible. So I'll print it out, and sometimes I'll take a walk and read the text. Sometimes I will put it on, I'll read it out loud and loop it on my phone, you know, maybe while I'm running or exercising or something else, cleaning the house. And I just want, I need to spend a lot of time with that text to understand what its concerns are, to understand why, perhaps what its, you know, kind of more sophisticated structure is. You just need to spend more time. So you can't think about sermon prep for a text like this as like McDonald's. It's not like takeout. You have to think about it more like a sit-down restaurant. So it's not, you know, McDonald's, it's Ruth's Chris or something like that, where you would spend much more time taking in the meal, trying to understand it. Just think about how much time it takes to build a human relationship and kind of the labor that it takes to really build trust with somebody. That's similar with the text. We have to spend a lot of time with them. So that's one thing, is that there's simply a time commitment factor that, like, hey, I want to preach on this text. I know it's really hard, but I need to spend time getting to know it. Okay, secondly, try as best you can to empathize and contextualize that text. So all of these texts were written for a reason. Many of them were specifically written to solve problems within their community, problems that might be very similar to our own. And so ask questions that help you to empathize more, like, what circumstances could have led an author to pen these words? Or for whom could this text have been good news? Oftentimes when I teach Amos and Jeremiah, or, you know, kind of prophetic texts like that, the students read the oracles of judgment, which are fierce, right? Especially Amos, both Amos and Jeremiah, right? Like Jeremiah, we have a whole word in English called a Jeremiad, and it's a way of talking about angry speech, you know, that somebody might be spouting off something angry. So these are hard texts, but as you start to dig into both texts like Amos and Jeremiah, you realize that most of those oracles of judgment are directed toward rulers, leaders, people with power, you know, the ability to influence society. And while those oracles would have been terribly bad news for the kings, you know, maybe the chief priest, other officials, those oracles of judgment might be very good news for those underfoot, or for those who might be suffering under the unjust reign of a ruler. To hear that those rulers were going to be judged could be a gospel song to somebody who is forced to live under the kind of the unjust and oppressive society that these kings and leaders had created. And so for whom could this text be a good news? Brian Blunt, who is a scholar of apocalypticism, also really one of the most prominent African-American scholars within my own field, he writes a lot on Revelation and also on apocalyptic literature. And I recently had a chance to interview him on my podcast, and we had a really great conversation about some of these texts like Revelation, which do employ violent imagery, right? And especially violent imagery toward oppressive political and economic structures. And he said that, he basically says, look, like it's one thing to critique these texts from like your suburban couch. I like to like read Revelation from a comfortable location where, like, if you live in America, you know, we're not at war right now, not with, you know, not in the terms of somebody trying to invade us or something like that. We're not in a state where society, as much as it feels like that, you know, where society is like literally on the verge of falling apart, like it has in places like Syria, or like it has in places like in some parts of Lebanon. But somebody in an environment where, why is this thing changing? Sorry about that. In environments where kind of society is on the verge of collapsing or is in a post-collapse state, hearing words about how the beast will fall or about how the monsters will be slain has a very different kind of resonance than it might be if you live in a place of power and privilege, as many of us do. And so we have to sort of attempt to try to empathize and contextualize some of these texts and say, like, for whom could a text like this actually be good news? Now, at the end of the day, you may still disagree with the text, and there's totally room for that, right? And we'll talk about that more later. You may disagree with the language of the text, and that's fine. But I think at the very least, we want to try and empathize and contextualize it. I mean, keep in mind that anytime we read, you know, a book from the Old Testament or the book of the New Testament, we're engaging in a kind of cross-cultural experience, right? Where for the Old Testament, these texts are thousands and thousands of years old. They also are for the New Testament as well. But they came from a culture that's very different from our own, a time very different from our own. And so we need to kind of beware of trying to understand them on their own terms. Okay, so that's the second point. Third point, examine the stone in the light of the valley or in light of the valley. What do I mean by this? What I mean is that every text that you pick up, whether it's in the New Testament, in the Gospels, or in the Epistles, or in the Old Testament, is part of a larger literary ecosystem. So, like the texts that we have in Matthew right now are part of a much larger gospel, right? And so you want to study that text in light of the broader literary ecosystem in which that text is found. So this is especially important for when I'm teaching in the prophets or teaching texts of judgment, that when we're preaching with them, we're kind of aware that, oh, after the word of judgment, there comes a word of salvation, right? After God's accusation comes healing. And so, like, the way that we talk about it as Lutherans is that we have law and gospel, right? God may come, like right now in this moment, in what month is it? It's October, 2020 is a blur. It's October. And the country has rightfully been in this larger, you know, conversation about racism. And there is a big finger of accusation there, right? And there should be, because a lot of stuff has been coming up to the surface. But as Christians, right, we can know that when God accuses, when accusation of sin comes, when sin comes to light, it is for the sake of facilitating healing. It's for the sake of bringing about salvation. It's not just accusation for its own sake. It's accusation so that we can move into a better future together. And so similarly with when we're reading difficult texts, we need to examine the particular stone in light of the larger ecosystem that we're working at. So if it's Matthew, it's Matthew, you know, reading one parable in light of what Matthew says more broadly, reading Isaiah in light of what the book of Isaiah says more broadly, that kind of thing. You can't study a fish without also studying the water that it lives in, or you can't at least understand it. Okay. All right, sports fans, pass the ball. Now, this came up in our last session. We had a really good conversation about how you and I may not be the best messenger of the text in front of us. There have been times in my life where I've encountered a text that I could potentially teach or preach on, but have felt that for different issues of my own background and identity, that the text might be better presented by somebody else or by some, for let me just take an example here. So in the Old Testament, books like Ezekiel and Hosea and Nahum have some very, very disturbing and violent imagery about women. It's sexually violent imagery, deeply disturbing. And I think it would be easy to make a case that a text like that, whether teaching on it or even just reflecting on it in a congregational setting, might be best done by a woman. Or might be best done by inviting one of my, you know, sister preachers or lay leaders within the congregation to say, I'm going to ask you to lead us in this conversation. And so there are times when it's appropriate, I think, to pass the ball on these hard texts. One of our colleagues in the last session, Anthony Chapman, who's a pastor, an African-American pastor, shared his experience of reading Paul on slavery. So Paul uses the language of slavery, right, in his epistles and at different points. And Paul even uses like the language of slavery to describe his own relationship to Jesus. Now, that was heard, of course, in a very particular and culturally, you know, particular way in the early church. When you use this language in the 21st century, it also gets heard, right? Especially in America, it also gets heard in a very particular way. And so sometimes we need to be aware of how our identity as preachers and teachers is impacting how a text might be heard or interpreted. So in some cases, maybe the best way to teach a text is actually to pass the ball or to preach the text, or is it at least to address the text in a way that other voices are part of that conversation. And thankfully, you know, we live in a time with such easy access to technology that you can have, you know, a congregational podcast where you might say as a pastor, well, I want you know, Chuck and Karen and Ingrid, I'm just looking at the three of you on Zoom right now, Chuck and Karen and Ingrid to talk with me about this text. And we're going to do it in kind of a roundtable kind of way and see what comes up in the conversation, see how the Holy Spirit leads us. And we can do that now in a way that we can share the insights of that conversation with the congregation more broadly. And that's another way, like I said, to pass the ball, right? As pastors and leaders, we don't always have to be the ones scoring the points, you know, or the ones who are sort of doing the teaching. It's important, I think, that we can invite people into this kind of work. Okay. Next. We need to beware of our inner colonizer. What do I mean by this? You know, the long history of colonization, colonization is not exclusively a Western or even a white problem. Colonization is a human problem, right? It's part of what it means to be a human being is that often we try to impose our vision of the world on other people and to do so in very violent ways. On analogy, we need to be careful that we are not attempting to colonize, sanitize, and domesticate these biblical texts, because oftentimes they are wild. Oftentimes they are dangerous. Oftentimes they don't fit easily into categories that we might want to impose on them. So we need to be careful that we aren't defanging, be careful that we aren't that we aren't attempting to colonize these texts and turn them into a more domesticated example. I'll give you an example. Somebody asked for one last session. I'll give you an example now. In just a few minutes, I'm going to talk about three famous texts. The one where Abraham challenges God not to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, God says, I'm going to destroy these cities. Abraham tries to bargain him down, right? So, well, you know, if there are this many people in there, don't destroy it. Well, what about this many people? And then Abraham says finally to God, shouldn't the judge of all the earth do what's right? You know, why are you going to destroy these things? So that's one text. The second text is when Moses, God again, you know, goes to Moses and said, hey, I'm going to wipe these people out. They created this golden calf. I'm done with them. Moses, we're starting over with you. Moses will have none of this. And Moses holds God's promises back up to God and says, no, you have promised to be, you know, the God of this people, do it. And then the third text is the story of the Canaanite woman in Matthew 15, I think, who challenges Jesus when, you know, Jesus says, well, I only came to the lost sheep of Israel. And she said, well, you know, even the little dogs, they eat the, you know, eat the crumbs from the masters. And she challenges him and she gets up in his face and says, no. Now, these are some pretty dangerous texts. Right. And there are ways that I've heard these preached that try to domesticate what's actually happening there. These are human beings who are challenging God. We need to avoid the temptation to try and colonize these texts, domesticate them, and make them less dangerous than they actually are. But that's hard to do. Okay. I just have three more tips here, and then we're going to jump into questions and comments and see what y'all think. This is related to the last point. Sometimes we just have to enter the fray and jump right in and be in conflict with text, and that's okay too. It is okay for us to talk about how when we read a text, we disagree with it. It's okay for us to do as Abraham and the Canaanite woman and Moses do and say, I don't know about that, God. I don't know about that text. And I think this is an important thing that we model for our congregations, that we can engage in that kind of honest discourse with God. God can take it, right? And when we are called to be pastors and church leaders, we are not called to be defense attorneys for the text. Like, the text can stand on its own, you know? And so don't be afraid to let people raise these critical questions and say, when I read that, it just makes me so mad. Well, tell me more about that. You know, that's great. Like, if I have a young person, I like to talk with college students a lot, and they really get into this role with scripture. And I love it. And I love it because you can tell, like, the fire that you see in their eyes and in their guts tells you that they're interested in these topics and engaged and they're passionate about them. So part of what we have to do is just encourage people to say, like, hey, when you hear that text, how does it make you, how do you respond to it? And if the answer is, well, I just hate it, then great. What you have there in front of you is an invested conversation partner, right? So, somebody who wants and feels deeply about this text, and that's awesome. Okay, two more things. Whenever we're dealing with difficult texts, we need to be aware of triggers and trauma. Now, there may be some really good reasons why you might not want to preach a text in a 7-minute sermon on a Sunday morning. And maybe you know something about your congregation's history. Maybe you feel like preaching on a text might make it difficult for some people, and that is, as pastors and leaders, we need to have, you know, the care of souls in front of us. And so I'm giving us a little bit of an off-ramp here, right? To say, like, look, there are some texts that I personally would generally avoid preaching in the, preaching. I might teach on them, you know, in like an adult education forum or in a time when more discussion can be had, maybe in an adult forum where we can all kind of look at the text together, process it, think through things. But we just have to be aware, of course, of how text might cause problems for people who have maybe domestic violence in their past or any number of different things, you know, that could cause problems there. So we just want to be aware of that. And then finally, this is my last kind of admonition. just give it a try. You don't have to preach the hard text every weekend, but maybe once a month, make it your practice that you are going to preach on the text that you don't want to preach on. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be a text that like offends you. It just needs to be a text that you think is hard, that you might initially look at it and say, okay, pass, let's go with this other one that feels like it's the easier route. Just make it a habit. Once a month is going to be your wrestling match sermon. And tell your people this, right? Say, hey, you know what? I'm trying to grow as a preacher. I think it's important for us as people of faith that we address the hard texts, especially at a time like this when we're addressing some of the hardest questions in our nation's history. Let's show people that we can do that within the pulpit too, and within our congregation as well. So trust the Spirit, right? That the Spirit will be at work even as we stumble forward, and take the risk. And I'll just reiterate the words of my doctoral supervisor: don't leave these texts to lesser preachers. Preach on them. Just because we avoid them doesn't mean that these texts won't be read or heard. Okay, I'm going to stop talking, and I want to invite you all to maybe submit questions in chat. I need to look at chat really quickly. I haven't seen it in a few minutes. Or if you just want to ask questions outright over the microphone, just jump right in. Again, I can't see all of your hands, so just open your mic and start talking. So Ann Palma has an interesting comment here, and I'm just going to read this. And Karis Weathers is, what is an example of a domesticating colonizing text? And Karis gives one. I can imagine when Jesus didn't really mean what he said to the Canaanite woman. He was just testing her. He knew all along that he would heal her daughter. He's omniscient after all. My Lord would never change his mind. I think this is a fantastic way of reading that text in a domesticated matter, when in point of fact, I don't see any evidence that Jesus knew, you know, like had some knowledge and was just sort of testing her. All indications in that text, to my mind, say that Jesus is responding in some very genuine ways to her challenge. And maybe we can even say that Jesus grows at that moment, right? Or his own imagination and thinking is expanded. But that's a dangerous reading, right? Potentially. Others, what do you think? And what questions are coming to your mind? Or here's another question I have for you. Have you all developed strategies for encountering difficult texts? Have you all maybe tried this out a little bit and found some ways that help you preach them or teach them a little bit more effectively?
Michael, this is Thomas. I can't say that I've found any way to help with my struggles. I've kind of probably guilty of domesticating some of the difficult tasks. And so I'm going to wrestle with that. But I struggle. I mean, there's a lot of them I struggle with, right? I struggle with ones on divorce. And, you know, how do we handle that? That's challenging in our day and age.
Yeah. And now, absolutely right, Thomas. And again, my job in this session is not to like give you short and easy answers to those difficult texts, because that would in many ways be like a violation of all the principles that I just shared with you about lingering long and thinking pastorally about how would I preach a text on divorce in your congregation? How would that be heard? How would that be heard by, you know, the divorcee in the second row, or you know, what are the details there? And all, so I'm not interested in like giving simple answers, but that's a great example though, Thomas, of texts that are just tough teaching, right? So I want to get to, I see another question here from Megan, but I want to get to Natalie Wimberly's. Yeah, Natalie, I saw your question about Psalm 137. You know what I'm going to do, Natalie, is actually do a screen share of that text. So in case folks don't remember. Okay. Psalm 137 is one of the most infamous psalms ever. It's just one of the most infamous psalms. And here's why. It's in many ways a beautiful psalm. It's also a deeply tragic psalm. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. So this is written by exiles, right? So people who have been forcibly deported, forcibly enslaved, forcibly moved to a land not their own. And that's why they're by the rivers of Babylon as opposed to by the River Jordan or something like that. On the willows there, we hung up our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. So their captors are in some ways asking for entertainment. Right? Entertain us with one of the songs about your once great city. But how could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. So there's a kind of protectiveness of the memory and the sense that if the songs were to be sung, they would somehow be defiled. I think of the image of when Jesus says, not to cast your pearls before swine. That's a similar kind of impulse here. You know, they don't want to cast the pearls of their beautiful Zion psalms. Remember, and now we get a little bit crazy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, who did not come to Judah's help. That's why the Edomites are being singled out, because the Edomites, right, are former brothers. Edom, the people of Edom are Esau's descendants. So in other words, they are Jacob's brother. So when they bring up the Edomites, they're talking about a family betrayal. That's why they're in there. Okay. Remember against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they said, tear it down, down to its foundations. O daughter Babylon, you devastator, happy shall they be who pay you back what you have done to us. And here it is. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rocks. Oh, it was pretty good up to that point. Now, Natalie, I want to know, since you posed the question, I don't know if you can unmute your mic or not. What do you see when you read that psalm?
Honestly, when I read that, it's disturbing to me because it speaks of killing not only the babies, but you're killing off the future of the people. It's almost like if you kill the children, then there is no hope that there is an additional generation that will come when they come out of exile. So it's hard. It is really hard. It's and I can't really find the peace to even approach it. I just kind of go, ooh. Well, and what they're really hoping is, I don't know. I don't. I just kind of waited. I'll stay every place but the seventh verse. I'll go above the seventh verse and leave the rest alone. Because it hurts. I mean, because, you know, you're thinking of killing off another generation. You think about this is vengeance against those who have held them captive. It's just messy. It's hard and messy is the way I look at it.
No, Natalie, I'm glad you brought up Psalm 137. In many ways, it's like kind of one of these quintessential texts that I'm talking about, a quintessential hard text. A few reflections here. One is, I think you're reading the psalm correctly when you see it as, this is a way, a prayer to snuff out a people, right? Mm-hmm. By ensuring that there is no future generation. In other words, that this would be the last Babylonian generation.
Yeah.
Is kind of, and you can feel the rage all across the chasm of thousands of years. You can still feel the rage of betrayal by the Edomites. And also just the violent conquest of the Babylonians. The psalm starts so beautifully, right? With all these kind of deeply, sorrow and wrath together in Psalm 137. I actually think when I read this psalm, I think about our current moment, Natalie, and the deep rage that has been in many ways kind of like caged up for a long period of time and is really like coming out and coming out, as you said, in some messy ways, right? Like messy, spilling out into our streets, you know, rightly dominating our public conversations. And I just wonder, like, is it possible that a text like this could actually be part of giving voice to the rage that we're feeling at this moment? Even though, like, the rage in its pure honesty is like, it looks.
I get that. I get rage. Yeah, yeah. I really get the rage. I get the anger. I get the need for vengeance. I get all of that. But because I'm typically a preacher of hope, I keep trying to find the hope in this. And surely the hope is not to have their little ones dashed against the rock.
I hear you. I agree with you fully that that would not be the hope. And in fact, Natalie, I'm sure you know this too, that there are a lot of Psalms, not just 137, that kind of wish harm upon the enemy. And sometimes I wonder, well, first of all, I think we can say outright, this is not a good thing. Like, vengeance is not a good seedbed for hope.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think we can, and I think we should feel free to say that from the pulpit, that there's a lot in this psalm that's true. There's a lot in the rage that I see in social media and in protests that is absolutely true. But sometimes that rage becomes destructive and even counterproductive. And I just wonder if Psalm 137, you can correct me or just push back on this, I wonder if Psalm 37 is precisely an example of that, of where sorrow has boiled over into destructive rage.
I agree with that. For what we see on the streets, not those quote unquote who are protesting peacefully or orderly, but for those, it's like their backs have been pushed against the wall. And I have no other way to express that which I'm feeling or what I am experiencing, but to be as vengeful and destructive and to let my anger, because we know anger that continues to be contained or not expressed becomes that much more destructive to the individual as well as the community in which the individual resides.
I think so. And I think we can, I think it's possible to say that the wounds that we see, especially in verses 1-6 of this psalm, are true, painful, and horrific. And I think we can also say the call for vengeance is just as horrific, that in some ways horror begets horror. That might be one way at least of approaching it, but I think there are probably a lot of different ways of thinking about a psalm like that. Okay, I need to revisit chat. Or is there anyone that wants to just jump in right here through the microphone while I look through these questions? So Ann Palma says, one strategy for working with a hard text, put it in conversation with a different text. The Bible says this, and it also says this. And I think this can be a very helpful thing. I'll give you an example that came up in the last session. So one of the most disturbing texts in Genesis is what we call the Akedah, right? The near sacrifice of Isaac. Remember when God commands Abraham to go sacrifice his son? And it's terrifying just that Abraham says yes, right? Ultimately, Isaac doesn't die, but he's like on the altar when he gets saved. He's nearly killed. So that's one text. Just four chapters earlier, though, in Genesis 18, you have Abraham fighting with God over the lives of Sodom and Gomorrah. And I have a Jewish colleague who lives in Jerusalem who often puts these two texts alongside one another and sees them as kind of paradigms of faith. Are we going to have a Genesis 18 faith that feels free to push back on God? Or are we going to have this kind of, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, faith, unquestioned submission to what God says. And for him, he much prefers the Genesis 18 version, right? Where humanity, you know, might ask questions of God, should not the judge of all the earth do what is right? But that's an interesting case where you can kind of say, hey, let's read this text alongside another and see what kind of fruitful conversation might emerge. Or Anne brings up Exodus 20 and Exodus 18, which I won't go into all the details there, but there was kind of a debate within exilic Judah about whether God sent judgment upon later generations for their parents' sins. And the premier example of this is actually the exile itself. So does anybody remember on whom the book of Kings blames the exile? Does anybody remember? It's Manasseh. Manasseh is the king that gets blamed for the exile, but the exile doesn't occur until like three, four generations after him. So it's kind of a narrative example of what we see in Exodus about, you know, God visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. Sometimes we call this generational sin. Ezekiel does not like this concept that the children, the way Ezekiel says it is, should the parents eat sour grapes and the children's teeth be set on edge? Yeah, which is such a beautiful image. I mean, a terrible image. I always feel it in my teeth whenever I say it. But there was a genuine debate within the biblical text about which of these two theologies of judgment was right. And that's an important thing for people to know, that the Bible doesn't always speak with one voice on every matter, that the Bible disagrees with itself on a whole host of issues. One thinks, for instance, of the, I like to bring this up in conversations about women's ordination. In the Old Testament, there is not agreement on who gets to be a priest. There are debates. If you read Deuteronomy, you'll get one answer. If you read Leviticus, you'll get another answer. If you read Chronicles, you'll get another answer. There have been debates about ordination, who gets to stand in this priestly kind of role, for millennia. And the biblical texts don't even agree when it comes to issues of priesthood. And so I like to bring that up just to say, like, look, these biblical texts are fighting with themselves on a lot of different things. So when we, you know, decide to engage them critically or talk about these hard texts in light of kind of different viewpoints, this is exactly what is happening everywhere within the Bible. That we just have, I think, about 6 minutes left. Does anyone want to pose a question over the microphone? Any additional thoughts to share, ideas?
So, how do you make peace with Judges 11, when Jephthah is sacrificing his daughter?
So, Natalie, I would say making peace is the wrong paradigm.
Okay.
Yeah. So, back to the story of Jephthah's daughter, I read that story as the story of a dumb man who made a dumb oath. It's the story of an idiot. You know what I mean? It's the story of a fool. And okay. In fact, Natalie, the book of Judges is full of fools.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so in many ways, I think, I don't necessarily think that because the story of Jephthah is in there, that means it's sort of has a seal of approval on it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like as if it's being held up as a commendable thing.
Okay. So I agree. Like,
go ahead. Yeah.
No, I agree. Because I kept thinking, I cannot see the sense of the necessity. I think he was overreaching in his commitment and dedication to God. You know, I don't believe God asked for that. Mm-hmm. That was just a foolish vow, a foolish promise that he made without probably thinking about what he was saying.
Yeah, It was foolish. And Judges is just, like I said, really a story of sin run amok. The whole thing is.
Yeah.
Well, friends, as we start to conclude, I will be happy to hang out for a few more minutes in case any of you want to kind of ask one-on-one questions. That's how we'd normally do it, right? If we were face-to-face, we'd have a chance to chat. But I want to just share one other thing with you. I would love to stay connected with you. I do have a podcast called Gospel Beautiful, which you can see the words there. And that podcast is really focused on it's a long form interview focused on kind of addressing challenges in 21st century ministry, 21st century gospel preaching. So would love to have you all check that out. You can find it on all the normal podcatcher apps and whatnot, or just type it into Google and you'll find it. But I am so grateful for the chance to chat with you about these things. I'm grateful for your tough questions. I really hope that you'll feel even a tiny bit more courage to take on these texts, even if you fall flat on your face, which is an experience that you know, every pastor has, like multiple times a week, probably. So have a great day. Thank you again for the chance to be with you.